The Turks have long been masters of the steppe. From the days of the she-wolf Ashina to the high peak of Mount Ötken, the Turks created a vast empire along the everlasting sea of grass. Göktürk, Khazar and Pecheneg, Cuman, Uzbek and Tuvan, as horse-born nomads, the Turkic peoples fanned across the known world, a story I'm sure many of you are familiar with as listeners of the Turkish History Podcast. Hi. My name is Edwin, and I am the host of the Nomads and Empires podcast. On my show, we focus on the history of the Eurasian steppes. We're covering topics that you've already heard of, such as the rise and fall of the first Turkic Khaganate, and at the same time, our show looks at other peoples like the Scythians and Sarmatians, and our lens will stay primarily focused on the perspective of the steppe. The history of the Turks is connected intimately with this region, but it is one of many narratives woven together on the broader tapestry. If you're interested in the history, politics, and culture of the Eurasian steppes, join me on the Nomads and Empires podcast. And now, back to the Turkish History Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Turkish History Podcast. Episode 24. The King of East and West. Before we begin, if you have been enjoying this podcast, I'd like to ask you to please subscribe, rate, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get this podcast. It would mean a lot to me, and would help more people find the podcast. Thank you for listening. So last time, we left off with Tughril having conquered northern and central Iran and the very first Turkish raids into Anatolia. Tughril was determined to present himself as the restorer of order and Sunni orthodoxy, a ruler in the Islamic mold, not a wild steppe warlord. But the Turkmen tribes that he depended on were making this difficult for him, and so many of the wilder Oghuz tribes had begun to set off to raid deep into Anatolia. We ended in 1050 with the Battle of Kapetron and the subsequent peace treaty between Tughril and Emperor Constantine Monomachos, where Tughril had been recognized by the Emperor of the Romans. The khutbah in the Mosque of Constantinople would now be read in his name and in the name of his master, the Sunni Abbasid Caliph, instead of in the name of the Shia Fatimid Caliph of Egypt, as had been done in Constantinople up until now. And today, we're going to cover how Tughril succeeded in not just conquering Iran and in becoming the paramount ruler of the Seljuks, but how he would come to be, in essence, the sole recognized temporal Sunni ruler in the whole Muslim world. How his claims to be the restorer of order and Sunni orthodoxy would ultimately come to be realized, and how the Seljuks would in a sense complete their transformation into proper Islamic rulers. But we will also see the continuing tensions within the emerging state, between what the Chinese would have called the cooked barbarian court and the raw Turkmen nomads simmering under the surface. And as we will see next time, this tension would ultimately lead to civil war. Now, as the Turkmen nomads were rampaging around Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Anatolia, basically what we discussed at the end of last episode, Tughril was active back in Iran. In 1043, under the leadership of Ibrahim Yanal, the Seljuks invaded Kirman in southeastern Iran, hoping to induce the local Buyid prince to surrender. The invasion started tentatively, but finding no resistance, Ibrahim Yanal and the Seljuk forces plunged deep into the province. The local Buyid rulers were able to mount a defense and drive back the Oghuz temporarily, but it seems that by 1045 at the latest, the Seljuks were in power in Kirman. In 1045, Seljuk forces also secured the submission of Azerbaijan, again essentially through negotiation with a local Sunni Kurdish dynasty. The khutbah was read in the name of Tughril, and the Oghuz were crucially given the right to pasture their herds in the phenomenal pasturages of Azerbaijan. In 1045, Tughril himself seems to have participated in the conquest of the city of Qazvin in western Iran, though yet again, this was accomplished ultimately through negotiation, and included the payment of 80,000 dinars to the Seljuks. Then, in 1046, Tughril himself marched from Rey and besieged the great city of Esfahan in central Iran. For 6 months, the city was subjected to a brutal siege by the Seljuk army. This was really the only truly major military operation in Tughril's conquest of Iran, but still, like elsewhere, yet again Tughril ultimately achieved victory through negotiation. The local Buyid prince agreed to submit to Seljuk authority, pay a sum of money, and read the Friday khutbah in the name of Tughril. With this recognition in hand, Tughril returned to Rey. The victory in Esfahan sealed Tughril's status as the real power in Iran. The great city was centrally located in the middle of the Iranian plateau and was by far the wealthiest and largest city that Tughril had yet taken. From here, the Seljuks could project their power across the whole of the Iranian plateau. So by the late 1040s, Tughril had become the supreme hegemon of Iran. However, the most important of the three Buyid mini-emirates, the one in Iraq, remained in Buyid hands. But aside from this, all of Iran, Khorasan, and Azerbaijan was now firmly in Seljuk hands. But as we said earlier, Tughril was interested in being more than just a nomad ruler. He was determined to be a ruler within the Perso-Islamic tradition, to be a real sultan. And critical for this project of legitimation and his state-building project, Tughril was desperate for recognition from the caliph. This would legitimize him as a Sunni ruler in the Perso-Islamic tradition. All of the bureaucrats and nobles and civil servants and judges that he needed to make a state work wanted to see recognition by the caliph. This would legitimize the regime in the eyes of the civilized Muslim elites who Tughril needed. In other words, it was a critical part of building a Seljuk empire, not just a Seljuk tribal confederation of wild Turkmen tribes. And so, throughout the early 1040s, messengers began traveling back and forth between Rey and Baghdad, between Tughril and the Caliph Al-Qayyim, who, remember, was virtually a prisoner of the Shia Buyids, who were still hanging on in Iraq. Though we don't know the details of the early negotiations between Tughril and Al-Qayyim, clearly, Tughril was positioning himself as the restorer of order and the defender of Sunni orthodoxy, a ruler in the mainstream of the Islamic tradition. And this was beginning to bear fruit. Caliph Al-Qayyim clearly initially regarded the Seljuks with a great deal of suspicion. He had, of course, already seen their kinsmen rampage through the Middle East, wreaking havoc and destruction in Iraq itself, really within a couple of days' ride of where he sat in Baghdad. At the same time, no doubt, the caliph began to entertain the notion that maybe these mighty people from the east could deliver him from his hated Shia imprisonment, so long as their wild Turkmen tribes could be controlled. So despite his deep apprehension, in 1043, Caliph Al-Qayyim sent his chief Qadi as an ambassador to Tughril, who was then in Jurjan. Tughril received the embassy with the highest possible honors and respect, and himself rode 4 leagues out of the city to personally meet the caliph's embassy on the road and escort him into the city. I personally imagine Tughril anxiously asking his viziers and cadis how he was supposed to act around the ambassador, keen to make a good impression and not come off as a rough barbarian. But of course, that's just the sort of detail that we just can't know. Likewise, we don't really know the contents of the negotiations at this time. Because he spoke no Arabic or Persian, Tughril had to rely on his grand vizier to translate for him. Tughril no doubt did everything in his power to convince the caliph's embassy of his Sunni bona fides, his intention to rule as a proper Islamic ruler, and promise to keep the tribes in check. The Chronicle of Bar Hebraeus says that the caliph demanded that in exchange for recognition, Tughril cease advancing further. But this does not appear in Ibn al-Athir's history or any of the other Islamic histories, so we just can't be sure. I'm sure that Tughril would have only promised this with fingers crossed in any event. Regardless, the embassy was a success, and the following year, the caliph's ambassador returned with a letter of recognition. Tughril was now the recognized ruler of all of the Seljuk domains, and the recognized Lord of Iran. This recognition was actually a twofold victory for Tughril. Like we said earlier, it legitimized his rule at home. Throughout Iran and Khorasan, the Iranian elites that he depended on to make his new state work now knew that he was a recognized, proper Islamic ruler, the legitimate overlord of Iran. But recognition by the caliph also enhanced Tughril's position within the Seljuk clan. Remember that Chahri still ruled in the east. Chahri, his brother, the man who had actually defeated the Ghaznavids and who had claimed the senior, eastern part of this new state for himself. Well, now Tughril had been recognized as the legitimate leader by the caliph, and additionally, through his canny political maneuvering, he had taken the lesser part of the Seljuk domains that he had been given, the city of Nishapur and the sparse cities of the Köpet Dağ mountain range, and turned them into a great empire. He was now lord not only of western Khorasan, but of all of Iran, while Chahri was merely the overlord of eastern Khorasan and Balkh, and was now mired in conflict with both the Karakhanids and the still-kicking Ghaznavids, trying to retake Balkh from their new home base in India. And it seems like there was nothing that Chahri could really do about this, though it does seem from the evidence that he never really made his peace with it. Coins he struck conspicuously omit Tughril's name. The khutbah continued to be read in Chahri's name in the east, and he also claimed the title Malik ul-Mulk, King of Kings, an Arabic rendering of the older Persian title Shan Shah. The Chronicle of Sistan even mentions a spat between the two brothers where both tried to appoint rival governors in Sistan, which lay on the border of east and west. The rival governors even fought minor skirmishes with each other before Chahri ultimately backed down. But despite not really liking it, and despite maintaining whatever symbolic defiance he could keep up in his own lands in the east, as a practical matter, Chahri was forced to recognize the reality. He had been outmaneuvered. His younger brother Tughril was now the paramount leader of the House of Seljuk. Tughril, for his part, accepted that Chahri was entitled to rule in his eastern domains and never forced the issue of the symbolic defiance that Chahri maintained. He was not going to start a civil war over khutbah readings and titles and coins. He was fine with having the real power, even if it meant sacrificing some of its trappings in the eastern realms ruled by his brother. Tughril was now the paramount leader of the Seljuk state, what was now well on its way to becoming the great Seljuk Empire. All of Khorasan, Balkh, Iran were now the domain of the House of Seljuk. It was a truly remarkable rise. Within a mere 15 years, what was essentially a band of Oghuz refugees fleeing into Khorasan had conquered half of the Muslim world. Now, Tughril's conquest of the Iranian plateau had been accomplished more or less through negotiation. Yes, the Seljuks did fight some relatively small battles, and they had laid siege to Esfahan, but there was a lot more of just sort of showing up in front of a city and bullying the local emir into accepting Seljuk sovereignty. And even when the Turks did fight battles, it was usually on behalf of some local Iranian emir, basically the Turks helping him defeat his local rival in exchange for a recognition of sovereignty and a payoff. All of this was coupled with Tughril determinedly working to present himself to the Iranian elites not as the steppe barbarian nomad that he was born as, but as a proper Sunni Muslim ruler, a sultan in the Perso-Islamic tradition. As the Chinese would have said, he was trying to prove that he was a cooked barbarian, not a raw barbarian. And this effort in Iran had largely been successful, and it was capped off by his recognition by the Abbasid Caliph in 1045. So during the next 5 or so years, Tughril continued to work hard to both entrench the power of his new state over Iran and to burnish his credentials as a proper Sunni ruler. As we discussed last time, in 1048, he finalized a peace treaty with the Byzantine Empire, pursuant to which he disingenuously agreed to stop his Turkmen tribes from raiding Anatolia and got the Emperor of the Romans to recognize him and have the Muslim prayers in the mosque in Constantinople be read in his name and the name of the Sunni Abbasid Caliph. But it is also during this period that Tughril really began to build out the Seljuk state. This form of state organization goes back to the Samanid models that we discussed back in episode 20, and was deeply informed by the Karakhanid models that we discussed back in episode 21. As we discussed then, the Samanids had pioneered this Perso-Islamic state structure based on existing Abbasid models that they then expanded. Well, now Tughril, the steppe nomad invader, like the Karakhanids, essentially adopted this state structure as part of his project of making himself a sultan in the sedentary Muslim world he now found himself the ruler of. Now, this process had begun all the way back in Nishapur in the late 1030s, when Tughril had sat on the throne and asked the Qadi to guide him. But by the mid-1040s in Rey, Tughril really began putting all of the pieces together. As he sat in Rey in the mid-1040s, a royal divan and a sophisticated bureaucracy built on the 10 ministries pioneered by the Samanids was put in place. Royal mints were churning out coins bearing the name of Tughril and the Caliph in Nishapur, Rey, and Hamadan. A Persian Grand Vizier was appointed in 1044, and a viceroy of a sort from a prominent local Persian family was sent to Nishapur to represent Tughril in Khorasan as the move to Rey became essentially permanent. We know that Tughril's Grand Vizier learned Turkish, because the sources say that he would act as a translator for Tughril, who spoke no Persian or Arabic and was illiterate. But despite this personal handicap, Tughril was intent on building not just a strong Seljuk steppe confederation, but a real Seljuk empire. Now, this new Seljuk state structure largely rested atop the existing political systems, which was indeed part of Tughril's determination to work within the existing political tradition. With the exception of Hamadan and Rey, which commanded the great pasturage of central Iran and were thus absolutely critical to his nomadic followers, Tughril really didn't attempt to directly rule any of the cities he conquered. He had achieved his supreme political position through essentially negotiation with the local lords, either by marching his armies up to the great cities to bully them into accepting his overlordship, or for smaller cities, essentially taking sides in local disputes to pick the winner and make that person recognize his sovereignty. Even after nominally submitting to Tughril, many of the local lords continued their bickering and squabbling, and were forced to call upon the Turks for aid, which of course Tughril was happy to do for a price. But in everyday life, your average person would not have noticed any real change, unless of course they were the unfortunate victim of an Oghuz raid. But slowly, the apparatus of a Seljuk government came into being and began to push down through the pre-existing political structures and reach everyday life. The first stage was Tughril sending out agents to the cities over which he was sovereign. These agents, termed Nuwab in Arabic, acted like a combination of ambassador and tax collector. Their purpose was both to manage communication between the subject lord and Tughril back in Rey, and to extract the tribute that had been agreed upon when the cities had submitted to Seljuk overlordship. So by the late 1040s and early 1050s, Tughril's state had become much more fully developed and become interested in more than just extracting revenue and guaranteeing that his Turkmen followers had pasturage. The new Seljuk Empire began to repair roads and construct fortresses along the crucial highways to ensure security for merchants in the late 1040s. And in 1051, Tughril promulgated an order for tax relief for the peasants, trying to entice people to return to work on the lands that had been abandoned in the chaos of the preceding decade. These are not the sort of things that nomad steppe confederations do, and they show the increasing sophistication of the Seljuk state. Now, this process was not entirely rosy. In 1049, Ibn al-Athir reports that a breach emerged between Tughril and Ibrahim Yanal, his cousin and foster brother, who had been the chief leader of the many Seljuk campaigns in Iran and the great campaign in Anatolia in 1048 that we discussed last time. The initial estrangement came about because Tughril, as part of his state-building project and his attempt to centralize power, had ordered that Ibrahim Yanal hand over to the central Seljuk state the fortresses around Hamadan in central Iran that he had been granted for his victories there. This was critical to the state controlling the rich pasture lands of central Iran. Now, Ibrahim Yanal appears to have been a much more traditional steppe leader than Tughril, and he was incredulous that this new centralized state was intruding on his rights to keep the spoils of war. And he quickly got into a huge fight with the Grand Vizier and essentially captured him, had him beaten in front of him, and then cut his lips off and put one of his eyes out. Pretty gruesome stuff. but not too far out of the norm for steppe warriors. Tughril was incensed, of course, and was even forced to defeat Ibrahim Yanal and his Turkmen in a minor battle. But ultimately, Tughril reconciled with Ibrahim Yanal, and probably felt that he needed him and his support among the wilder of his Turkmen tribes. You know, in this podcast, we've seen over and over again what I've called the modernist, traditionalist divide in steppe societies. The divide between those who want to develop a state along the lines of sedentary society, to become cooked, as the Chinese would say, and the traditionalists, who want to keep to the steppe ways, who want to stay raw. Tughril was a modernizer par excellence. Probably the biggest modernizer in history to this point, and really until the rise of Kublai Khan centuries later, whereas Ibrahim Yanal was a traditionalist, and a man greatly popular with the wild Turkmen tribes that he had led to conquer central Iran and raid Byzantine Anatolia. Naturally, Tughril building a real state in the Perso-Islamic tradition was going to cause some problems and some tension. And spoiler alert, this struggle isn't over, and this divide is going to rear its head again. Indeed, the tensions between the cooked Seljuk court and the raw Turkmen tribes is going to run right through all of Seljuk history. But despite this spat with Ibrahim Yanal, Tughril was very successful in constructing the Seljuk state. He was making good on his claim to be the restorer of order, and across Iran, the great Seljuk Empire entrenched itself. The final pieces of southern Iran, including Shiraz, were also finally brought under Seljuk dominion in the early 1050s, and Tughril also saw off a Ghaznavid attempt to retake Khorasan in eastern Iran, riding east to aid his brother Chahri, and yet again defeating the House of Ghazna. It was also around this time, in the year 1055, that Tughril himself invaded Anatolia. Now, Turkmen raids into Anatolia were actually kind of constant. As we discussed last time, the Seljuk court saw Anatolia as essentially a release valve for the wild Turkmen and potentially rebellious Seljuk princes. So even after the peace deal following the Battle of Kapetran, Turkish raiding continued, with Tughril constantly protesting to the emperor that those weren't really his Turkmen. As the Byzantine historian Michael Ataliates writes, "It was from this moment on," by which he means the signing of the peace treaty, "that formal relations began between the Sultan and the Roman Empire. But the raiding did not stop because of the Huns' rapacious nature, though the Sultan excused himself by saying that not even he knew the identity of these plunderers who, like wild wolves, were making the raids." And Ataliates was actually a very powerful jurist and lawyer and a member of court, and therefore a first-hand witness to a lot of this stuff. But in 1055, Tughril dispensed with the fig leaf that he really couldn't stop the Turkmen and actually led a great campaign into Anatolia himself. The likely trigger was the death of Emperor Constantine Monomachos in January of 1055. Tughril likely saw this as an opportunity to enhance his reputation and control over the Turkmen tribes as the Roman Empire turned inwards and fell into civil war between claimants to the throne. In the chaos, as the eastern frontier of Byzantium was denuded of troops, Tughril struck. He raided deep into Anatolia, making for a fortress city that happened to be called Manzikert, which I promise you will come up again in our story. Ibn al-Athir relates, "He, Tughril, then went to Armenia, moving against Manzikert, which belonged to the Byzantines. He invested it, it was a strong city, and put the population under severe pressure. The neighboring lands he plundered and destroyed." But Manzikert was destined to hold out, at least for now. Michael Ataliates tells us, "Before the death of the emperor, the Sultan set out with a fully equipped army, as he had decided to attack and seize the city of Manzikert by force. He made vigorous attempts against the walls, but accomplished nothing of what he had hoped for the commander of the Romans, Basileus, who was surnamed Apokapes, resisted him energetically and repelled the siege engines. Reportedly, a Byzantine sortie from the walls resulted in one of Tughril's siege engines being destroyed. In the words of Ataliates, he, a Latin mercenary soldier, took a jar containing a concoction of Median fire, which by the way is likely a concoction of oil, ran out of the gates of the city into the very midst of the enemy, affixed a flame to the mouth of the jar and smashed it upon the engine. A fire immediately was kindled, ignited, and engulfed the entire engine, burning it up, for certain fabrics had also been hung from it to deflect the missiles of the defenders on the walls. With his siege failing, Tuchel decided to give up on conquering Manzikert. Instead, he broke off the siege and raided as far as Erzurum. Ibn al-Athir relates, "In this raid on the Byzantines, the Sultan Tuchel Bey achieved great exploits and took from them a vast amount of booty and killed and captured a great many. For good measure, Tuchel also forced a local Arab emir, a border lord ruling a territory on the edge of the Muslim and Christian worlds, to recognize his sovereignty and pay him tribute. Tuchel then returned back to Azerbaijan and Iran, laden with plunder, but with Manzikert in Roman hands, at least for now." Meanwhile, as Tuchel was building a real Seljuk state in Iran and invading Anatolia, the remnant of the Buyid Emirate in neighboring Iraq was beginning to fall apart. Things have been going badly for the Buyids for a while at this point. Even before Tuchel and the Seljuks had destroyed the Iranian components of the Emirate in the 1040s. But the wheels really started coming off the bus upon the accession of the last Buyid emir, Al-Malik al-Rahim, in 1047. Now, I'm not going to go through all the twists and turns of the power struggles of the last claimants to the Buyid throne. But in essence, Al-Malik al-Rahim was mired in conflict with his brother, who also claimed the throne. The struggle was bitter and bloody, and as the brothers fought for the throne, the state collapsed around them. Now, as the Buyids were Shia, the relations between them and the Sunni Abbasid Caliph in Baghdad were always quite tense. The Buyids knew they couldn't really get rid of the Caliph, as this would spark a huge crisis, and so the Abbasid Caliph was essentially locked up in a palace in Baghdad. The Buyids basically did their best to ignore the Caliph that they were forced to host, scarcely recognizing his authority at all. This, of course, led to increasing tensions between the Shia and the Sunni in the Buyid domains in Iraq, made worse as the dynasty began to collapse. Ibn al-Athir notes serious disturbances in Baghdad itself in 1051 and 1053. And as the Buyid Emirate started unraveling, there were several contenders for power in Iraq. The most powerful, the man who looked set to take over, was a man named al-Basasiri, who was the Turkish commander of the Caliph's slave bodyguard. Now, we haven't really checked in on the slave army since all the way back in episode 19, but it has still been kicking around, though its ranks were far, far reduced from what they were during the anarchy. The money to maintain a truly massive slave army just wasn't there, and as the Buyids came to take over Iraq, they naturally wanted to make sure that the Caliph's slave army was under their control. Naturally, pro-Buyid Shia commanders were put in charge of the guard, and al-Basasiri was, predictably, a Shia. Now, the Turkish slave soldiers themselves largely didn't really care about Shiism or Sunnism, of course, as long as they were getting paid. But as the Buyid dynasty started falling apart, al-Basasiri realized that this might be his chance to take over. By 1049, al-Basasiri had conquered the city of Basra in southern Iraq, and by 1052, he had conquered Anbar in northern Iraq. Ibn al-Athir reports other military expeditions by al-Basasiri in the late 1040s and early 1050s to take fortresses and entrench his power in Iraq. Now, this was supposedly on the orders of the emir, al-Malik al-Rahim, but everyone knew that it was really al-Basasiri who held the power. By 1053, al-Basasiri was essentially in control of Iraq, nominally ruling with al-Malik al-Rahim's blessing. He was naturally opposed in this by the Sunni Abbasid Caliph al-Qayyim, who was desperate to escape being a virtual prisoner of the Shia heretics. The collapse of the Buyids was an opportunity that just couldn't be missed, and the Caliph did not want to replace one Shia prison guard with another. This was felt all the more acutely by the Caliph's most powerful official, his vizier, Ibn Muslima. Now, Ibn Muslima was a power in his own right, I think to call him the power behind the caliph's throne is a bit overstating it, but it's not that far off the mark. And Ibn Muslima was a Sunni fanatic. He loathed the Shia with a burning hatred that today would only be comprehensible to members of Al-Qaeda or ISIS. Naturally, he hated al-Basasiri both for religious reasons and because, of course, any ambitious politician hates his rival. And Ibn Muslima would be damned if he was going to let this Shia commander of the caliph's Turkish slave army supplant the falling Buyids. But who could defeat al-Basasiri and the Turkish slave troops? There were no equals to Turkish steppe warriors, and he had neither armies nor military experience in any event. Who could he turn to? And thus, unsurprisingly, Ibn Muslima began reaching out to the greatest Sunni power he could find. Someone with his own Turkish steppe warriors, who could defeat al-Basasiri and deliver the caliph from these Shia heretics. And so, in the early 1050s, the Abbasid caliph's powerful grand vizier reached out to Tughril, inviting him to intervene in Iraqi politics and to save the caliphate. Tughril, for his part, saw the crumbling Buyid emirate as a great opportunity, and saw Ibn Muslima as a critical person to cultivate in his efforts to both expand the great Seljuk Empire and to present himself as a defender of Sunni orthodoxy. This could be a great opportunity, not just to burnish his credentials as a Sunni ruler, but perhaps to even rescue the caliph from his virtual imprisonment by the Shia heretics, and also thus bring all of Iraq under his dominion. And who knew where he could go from there? Perhaps the Seljuks would not just be the restorers of order and Sunni orthodoxy in Iran and the East, but perhaps in all of the lands of Islam. So Tughril and Ibn Muslima began something of a mutual appreciation society. In 1052, Ibn Muslima sent envoys to Tughril bearing robes of honor and a letter from the Caliph Al-Qa'im bestowing on Tughril further titles, likely including Mawla Amir al-Ma'mumin, meaning the agent of the commander of the faithful. Shortly thereafter, in 1053, Tughril and Ibn Muslima simultaneously launched an official persecution of the Shia and other heterodox Muslim sects termed a mihna, though the persecution did not affect non-Muslims. The mihna was declared simultaneously by Tughril in Nishapur and by Ibn Muslima in Baghdad, further tightening the bond between the two men. However, it does seem that Tughril, for his part, didn't actually implement the persecution, which would have destabilized his regime, and he saw this basically as a symbolic act. With the groundwork thus laid, Ibn Muslima and Tughril began discussing a potential Seljuk invasion of Iraq to get rid of al-Basasiri and the remnants of the Buyids. Fortuitously, the opportunity soon presented itself. In late 1053, shortly after the proclamation of the official persecution by Ibn Muslima and Tughril, a revolt of the Arabs and Kurds began in northern Iraq. Al-Basasiri rode out of Baghdad to put it down, but was unsuccessful. Then, in early 1054, the Turkish slave bodyguard of the caliph started rioting in Baghdad. This happened for the same reason we've seen the Turkish slave army riot before. They hadn't been paid. According to Ibn al-Athir, it was Ibn Muslima himself who had withheld their pay, perhaps to undermine his hated rival, the guard's commander, al-Basasiri. Regardless, the Turkish slave troops besieged the caliph's palace in Baghdad and then rode throughout the city, looting and burning. The troops were eventually paid off and the riot ended, but al-Basasiri came out of it weakened, and a rift began to grow between him and his nominal overlord, the last Buyid emir, al-Malik al-Rahim. And upon hearing the news of the chaos in Baghdad, the Arab and Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq went on the offensive. With al-Basasiri thus weakening, Tughril and Ibn Muslima decided that now was the time to strike. The Seljuks swept down from the Iranian plateau and into Khuzestan, the low, flat land in southwestern Iran bordering Iraq. Now, Khuzestan is always key to any war between Iraq and Iran. It borders the great Zagros Mountains that rise up to protect the Iranian plateau, and some of the only passes through the Great Mountain Range are in Khuzestan. For those of you more familiar with Western history or Turkish history, it is analogous to Cilicia in Anatolia, which is a low, flat land bordering the Great Taurus Mountains that rise up into the Anatolian Plateau, and where the Great Cilician Gates serve as one of the only good passes to and from the plateau. So control of Khuzestan was going to be critical for any Seljuk invasion of Iraq. The Seljuks moved in two great armies, one attacking the north, and the other moving into the center of Khuzestan towards the city of Ahvaz. In keeping with his pretenses to be a proper Islamic ruler, Tughril attempted to stop his Turkmen tribes from pillaging the countryside. This was, of course, entirely unsuccessful. As Ibn al-Athir writes, he did not lay his hands on anyone's money or other property, but the Oghuz were not of one mind with him about that, and indulged in plunder, pillage, and extortion, so that the inhabitants experienced distress and violence at their hands. Khuzestan quickly fell to the might of the Turkmen, and within a month, the whole of the region was overwhelmed. With Khuzestan now in Seljuk hands, the road to Baghdad was open. No army stood between the Seljuks and the city that was the jewel of the Islamic world. But Tughril did not want to be perceived as a steppe invader, a savage Khan from the steppes come to sack Baghdad. That unfortunate disaster, at the hands of the Mongols, was still centuries away. He was determined to continue to portray himself as a Sunni ruler in the mainstream of the Islamic tradition, which he saw as absolutely critical to his regime. So Tughril dashed off messengers to Baghdad and indeed throughout the Muslim world, announcing that he was traveling to Khuzestan, but for the purposes of going on Hajj to Mecca. And the reason he just happened to be traveling with a massive army wasn't that he was going to march on Baghdad. Quite the contrary, he was going to go invade Egypt and overthrow the Fatimid so-called caliph, that Shia heretic who had set himself up in opposition to the rightful Abbasid caliph, his master, Al-Qayyim in Baghdad. And if that required stopping off in Baghdad on his way to Mecca in Egypt to visit with his master the caliph, well, I mean, that just can't be helped, can it? With his Sunni credentials now beyond reproach, Tughril assembled a massive horde of Oghuz nomads in central Iran and began marching towards newly conquered Khuzestan. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, Ibn Muslimah set into motion his part of the plan. Even more than Tughril, Ibn Muslimah did not want to see a Seljuk siege of Baghdad. The death and destruction would be horrific, and everyone knew that whatever Tughril might promise, and however good his intentions might be, the Turkmen nomads could not actually be controlled. If they wanted to pillage, they would pillage. I mean, look what had happened in Khuzestan just like a couple months ago. This was a very delicate game. Tughril had to be welcomed into the city. He could not be allowed to put it to siege. That was the only way to get rid of the Shia heretics, the Turkish head of the slave army al-Basasiri, and the last Buyid emir, al-Malik al-Rahim, that did not involve mass destruction. Ibn Muslimah started by taking advantage of the ongoing disorder in the city to attack al-Basasiri. First, civil disturbances between Sunni and Shia Baghdadis had broken out, potentially instigated by Ibn Muslimah himself. The Sunni common people had assembled and come to the Divan, essentially demanding that the state enforce the Sunni understanding of the Sharia. The term used is the ordering of the good and the prohibition of evil. Ibn Muslimah, of course, orchestrated it so that the Divan would agree to this. Following this, a group of the common people strode off and attacked a boat transporting wine that was run by a Christian who was al-Basasiri's man, according to the sources. Now, the history of alcohol in the Muslim world could easily consume a whole podcast episode. It is, of course, officially prohibited in Islam, but the reality is that alcohol consumption has gone through periods of prohibition and tolerance, and has been seen more or less unfavorably by both Sunnis and Shia over time. At this time and place, however, alcohol consumption was generally not seen as that big of a deal by the Shia and by the more moderate of the Sunni. Al-Basasiri was furious that his guy's wineship had been destroyed, and so he got a bunch of more liberal Sunni scholars to issue a fatwa, which is essentially a legal opinion, that what the mob did was wrong because they destroyed this Christian guy's personal property. This was really not appreciated by the stricter Sunnis and by those who had actually destroyed the wineship. And Ibn Muslima, of course, used this. He strode out and basically began to publicly malign al-Basasiri, saying that he was a Shia heretic who was undermining the very commandments of Allah. Then he went further, saying that the Shia al-Basasiri had in fact been in communication with the Shia Fatimid Caliph in Egypt and was secretly working for him to end the Abbasid Caliphate, which was of course a totally baseless claim, at least for now. The incensed Sunni masses demanded permission to attack al-Basasiri's personal residences, which of course Ibn Muslima was more than happy to agree to. Indeed, he had likely orchestrated this whole thing to get to this point. Incited by Ibn Muslima, the mob overran al-Basasiri's palaces, pillaged them, and burned them to the ground. At the same time, Ibn Muslima went to the Turkish slave soldiers and told them, "I don't have a problem with you. It's just al-Basasiri, who, by the way, is the root of all of your troubles, and I'll make sure to pay you when he's gone." So the walls were now closing in on al-Basasiri. The Sunni mobs, incited by Ibn Muslima, had turned on him, even burning his house to the ground. His popularity and standing with his nominal overlord, the last Buyid emir, al-Malik al-Rahim, had already been weakened by the previous violence committed by his Turkish slave troops and his failure to stop the Arab and Kurdish revolt in the north. Now his own Turkish slave troops themselves seemed indifferent to his attempt to stay in power. And perhaps most importantly of all, word had come that the mighty Tughril was approaching from the east. The Divan now advised al-Malik al-Rahim to officially dismiss al-Basasiri as commander of the guard. And in desperation, al-Malik al-Rahim tried to save his own skin by agreeing with their recommendation. Reportedly, al-Malik al-Rahim said, "We are obedient to the commands of the Divan, and we shall disassociate ourselves from him." Al-Basasiri realized that there was now no way for him to stay in power or even in Baghdad. The game was up. He fled to the north, abandoning the city. Meanwhile, Tughril had begun marching from Khuzestan towards Baghdad. Tughril was still eager to take the city without violence, and as he heard that the Buyid regime was on its last legs, he rushed to assure the city that there was nothing to fear. Ibn al-Athir writes, "Tughril Bey sent an envoy to the caliph with exaggerated protestations of allegiance and submissiveness, and also to the Baghdad Turks, promising them fair and handsome treatment." Now the Turkish slave troops at first objected to Tughril's marching into Baghdad and tried to get the Caliph al-Qayyim to order him to stop his advance. But Ibn Muslima was having none of it, and it appears that the Baghdad Turkish slave troops were in essence just bought off. Seeing the writing on the wall, al-Malik al-Rahim decided that there was no point in fighting. The slave army was not with him. The Buyid Emirate was in full collapse. Arab and Kurdish rebels were pushing in from the north, and al-Basasiri had fled with whatever troops might still be loyal. It was over. The Buyid Emirate was finished. And thus, the last Buyid Emir wrote to the Caliph, expressing his humble obedience and stating that he left it to him to act as his sentiments dictated, to establish a basis for relations with Tughril Bey. The Caliph ordered al-Malik al-Rahim and his remaining vassals to offer allegiance and submission to Tughril, which they promptly did. Upon receiving this submission of al-Malik al-Rahim, Tughril quickly promised to treat him, his family, and his remaining vassals well. And so, Baghdad fell to Tughril without a fight, without one arrow being fired or one catapult being erected or one gate being battered. Even before Tughril entered the city, the Caliph al-Qayyim ordered the khutbah to be read in both Tughril's name and in his own name, in the mosques of the city. Now, as I said last time, Tughril's conquests were more diplomatic victories than military victories. He really broke the stereotype of the brutal nomadic invader, the Khan on horseback, crushing his enemies. Tughril was more of a diplomat on horseback, shrewdly working within the political system of the settled civilization he found himself the ruler of. Now, that's not to say he was non-violent, far from it. And the Oghuz tribes that fought under him were just as capable of pillage as any traditional steppe people. It's just that Tughril, more often than not, used violence and the threat of it as a negotiating tactic to achieve victory at the negotiating table. Tughril would always prefer marching into a grand palace and having his name read during the Friday prayers to presiding over a tower of skulls outside a ruined city as his Turkmen tribes raped and pillaged and burned. And his victory in Baghdad was really the culmination of this strategy, his greatest victory. Taking the greatest city in the world without a shot being fired. Indeed, he was even invited in. Tughril reached Baghdad on December 15, 1055. Eager to continue in his role as defender of Sunni orthodoxy, the restorer of order, the very savior of the caliphate even, he stopped outside the gates and sent a formal request to the Caliph Al-Qa'im asking for permission to enter the city. This was granted with all due pomp and circumstance. According to Ibn al-Athir, the vizier, Ibn Muslima, came out to meet him with a large retinue of qadis, syndics, sheriks, notaries, eunuchs, and the leading state officials, and the leading emirs of al-Malik al-Rahim's army accompanied him too, in front of the notables. Ibn Muslima administered an oath of loyalty to the caliph to Tughril. Tughril then entered the city on December 18, 1055. He came before the caliph Al-Qa'im, who presented him with 7 fine silken robes, representing the 7 climes of the world, and the so-called crown of Khosrau, a fabulous crown whose name harkened back to the old days of the Sassanid dynasty, before the coming of Islam. The caliph then proclaimed him to be the Shan Shah, the ancient Persian title meaning the King of Kings, which dated from ancient, ancient Iranian history. And he proclaimed him to be Malik al-Mashriq wal-Maghrib, Arabic for the King of East and West. The caliph enjoined him to fear God, uphold justice, and prevent oppression. Thus, Tughril was declared by the caliph in Baghdad to be, in essence, the universal temporal Islamic ruler. The first such ruler since the anarchy at Samarra had sundered the caliphate nearly 200 years earlier. The man to re-knit the lands of Islam, to rejoin what had been broken. This man from the steppes, who had been born among the Oghuz when they were a weak and disorganized people on the fringes of the civilized world, who had been raised among the herds in felt tents, an illiterate man who spoke no Arabic or Persian, and who started his career a mere 20 years earlier as one of a handful of leaders of a small band of Turkish refugees, was now the master of the largest, wealthiest, and most sophisticated city on the globe. And he was, in effect, recognized to be the sole temporal ruler of the whole world by the Caliph of Islam. But it turns out that this would be the highlight of Tughril's career in many ways. And next time, we will finish the story of Tughril as the great Seljuk Empire continues its march to fulfill the promises laid out in Baghdad. And as it falls victim to the perpetual curse of Turkish states, civil war.